listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and pleased to have you with us. We've got a surprise for you here in the second hour. I'm not even going to lay it out just in case it doesn't happen, but it's going to be an interesting day here. And in the first hour, Rand Paul, right now, as we speak, is standing on the floor of the Senate filibustering the president's nomination of Mr. Brennan to head the CIA. Now, this is really important, and it's important for a reason that probably you have not thought of. I think a lot of people haven't considered this in the context of its impact on what I'm going to talk about here. Back in July of 2009, okay, this is 4 years ago, roughly, 6 months into the first term of Obama's presidency, Louise and I were back in Michigan for our family reunion, kind of annual hoop-de-doo picnic thing. And one of my brothers is a sport and target shooter, and we were visiting, and so, you know, hey, let's go down and do some target practice, some target shooting. So we went to one of Central Michigan's biggest gun stores to buy some ammunition. Steve had guns. Actually, I rented a gun when I was there as well. And in fact, as I recall, I rented a 40 caliber Ruger. But in any case, this was, you know, this giant gun store. It was a gun store that was like the size of a mini Walmart. It was huge. It was big, right? They had hundreds, thousands of guns and a wall full of ammunition, or a wall full of half-empty shelves that usually were overfilling with ammunition. And when we got to that store, the owner said he couldn't sell me more than 50 rounds. 50 rounds a person, maybe it was 100 rounds. It was some limit like that, basically a box. Maybe it was two. Because the store was running low on ammo. So I asked why the store was running low on ammo, and his response was along the lines of, because, I don't know how to say this, this is verbatim recollection, because that N-word in the White House has taken all our guns away and people are stocking up. Now, this was 4 years ago. I was astounded. And I said, you know, how do you know that he wants to take all your guns away? I didn't even deal with the obscenity. And he says, I got the emails to prove it. That the federal government is not only planning to take away everyone's guns, but that Obama is even planning on taking out people he doesn't like. This all took place 4 years ago. At that time, the government-hating gun store owner represented a fringe group in America, and or maybe he wasn't the owner, an employee. And at that time, information about how the government was running out of control, way beyond the constraints the founders put into the Constitution, that kind of thing, that was pretty much the kind of talk that you heard on far-right extremist shortwave radio, you know, on emails and websites, right-wing websites. And that was pretty much it. Well, times have changed. Now the gun nuts who are stocking up on ammo and forming right-wing extremist hate groups have the Attorney General of the United States telling them that he and the president reserve the right to kill them if he thinks they're a threat. Yes, you heard that right. Attorney General Eric Holder is not ruling out a scenario in which the president could order a drone strike against American citizens on U.S. soil. Now, his comments released Tuesday were prompted by questions raised over the nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA. Specifically, Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, had asked whether the Obama administration had considered using its drone policy domestically. In a letter to Senator Paul dated Monday, Holder said it was conceivable, quote, I suppose, he said, to foresee a, quote, extraordinary circumstance in which it would be necessary and appropriate, end quote, under U.S. law for the President of the United States to authorize the military to use lethal force, his phrase, within the United States. responding to Holder's comments. Now, actually, let me just go on a little farther. The example that Eric Holder gave was essentially, if, you know, we knew that the 9/11 planes were going to hit the trade towers and we could shoot them down over, he didn't say it in this kind of language. I'll read you the actual letter. But, you know, we could shoot them down like, you know, that flight in Pennsylvania went down in Shanksville. That's something that we should have the power to do. In fact, here's how Holder phrased it. He said, the question you have posed is entirely hypothetical, unlikely to occur, and one we hope the president will never have to confront. It is possible, I suppose, to imagine an extraordinary circumstance in which it would be necessary and appropriate under the Constitution and applicable laws for the president to authorize the military to use lethal force within the United States. For example, the president could conceivably have no choice but to authorize the military to use such force if necessary to protect the homeland in the circumstances of a catastrophic attack like the one suffered on December 7, 1941. In other words, shoot down the Japanese fleet as they're about to drop bombs on Pearl Harbor. And September 11, 2001. In other words, shoot down those planes before they were able to strike the Pentagon or the White House or the... And there's still a debate, actually, about whether that plane in Pennsylvania was shot down. Not so much a debate. There's still some discussion around the edges. But in any case, Senator Paul's response was that, okay, well, that's the obvious easy stuff, but what about all the stuff in the middle? Responding to Holder's comments, Senator Paul issued a statement in part that said, the U.S. Attorney General's refusal to rule out the possibility of drone strikes on American citizens and on American soil is more than frightening. It is an affront on the constitutional due process right of all Americans. And I got to say, as much as I think Rand Paul is a crackpot, particularly his economic, you know, on economics, Rand Paul is, you know, crackpot off the scale. He's a libertarian. But on this issue, Senator Paul is right. Way back in June of 1878, following the Reconstruction era, or during the Reconstruction era, following the Civil War, Congress passed the Posse Comitatus Act. The intent of that act, which was a distant grandson of the Insurrection Act of 1807, was to limit the powers of the federal government when it came to using federal military personnel to enforce state laws against Americans on American soil. Basically, the Army can't turn its guns on citizens. The law was modified in 1981 to make it explicit that it was referring to the powers of the armed forces. The law was modified in 1981 to refer to the powers of the armed forces. In 2006, the Bush administration urged Congress to revoke Posse Comitatus so that U.S. armed forces could restore public order and enforce laws in the aftermath of natural disasters, terrorist attacks, or other, quote, conditions. Congress went along with Bush's request. They passed as part of the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, in 2007. So Obama comes in. And in 2012, they're putting together, I mean, every year they've got to reauthorize the military. This is in the Constitution. You can't let the military run more than 2 years without reauthorizing it. So in 2012, Obama said, put Posse Comitatus back in there. And they did in the NDAA of 2012. It was one of the actually good things that was done. But it had a loophole that military personnel could still be used to detain, quote, a person who was a part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners, including any person who has committed a belligerent act or who has directly supported such hostilities in aid of such enemy forces. That's one pretty damn large loophole. We'll get into more of this right after.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, I thought that the judicial branch of government was who decided who was guilty and what the penalty would be, not the executive branch. So, as I was saying, I mean, that's one pretty damn large loophole. Basically to say, well, yeah, you know, we can blow up people from the sky, or actually any other form of assassination of Americans. if we think that they're associated with Al-Qaeda or whatever, you know, it's just a huge loophole. Down. So, Shane, play this clip of, this is Rand Paul on the floor of the Senate today. Yeah, play that saw one.
Now, when the president says he doesn't intend to do so, you really have to think that through. The president a year ago signed a law that says that you can be detained indefinitely,
that you can be sent from America to
Guantanamo Bay without a trial. And he wants us to be comforted.
Back up.
He wants us to remember and think good of him because he says, I don't intend to do so. Well, it's not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. I mean, with this giant loophole, it's really bizarre that we find ourselves today in a time of U.S. history when the executive branch of the federal government. Now, consider this. I mean, you know, we three branches of government. That was the whole idea. Executive, judicial, congressional, right? Congressional makes the law. Executive carries them out. And the judicial determines the punishments, as it were, that the executive branch would consider killing American citizens on American soil, regardless of what the Constitution says. Now, you could argue that the executive branch should have the power to do the killing, but not to make the decision about the killing. And the judicial branch, which the Constitution says is supposed to make all the judicial and criminal punishment determinations, is losing its power to the executive branch of government, while our rights are to due process are fast becoming a distant memory. And equally important, and here's why I started with the story of the gun show guy. This is what I think is so important, is that the talk of the tinfoil hat conspiracies and talk of an overreaching government that wants to kill you and take away your guns, that talk is now not just on the right-wing fringe websites and the shortwave radio stations. It was easy to dismiss people like that gun shop guy when all he could quote was an email he got from somebody. I can show you the email. Right. But today, the assertion by the Attorney General of the United States that the president could kill you with a drone is on the front page of the New York Times. It's talked about in the mainstream media. United States Senator Rand Paul is holding a talking filibuster on that topic today on the floor of the U.S. Senate. I mean, good luck telling that crazy gun owner that he's crazy. So what's the result of this? We have legitimized all this fear and paranoia, and as a result, more and more Americans are starting to fear their government, which they are increasingly perceiving as being no longer constrained by the Constitution, something that started right after 9/11 with the Bush administration. And since fear is what usually drives hate, we're seeing more and more right-wing extremist hate groups. In fact, according to a new study by the Southern Poverty Law Center, quote, the number of conspiracy-minded anti-government patriot groups reached an all-time high of 1,360 in 2012, and the number of hate groups has remained at near record levels of more than 1,000. There's only one way to put an end to all this fear and to the hatred of our government that is sweeping our nation, and particularly on the hard right, and that's for us to return to our core values, the values on which this nation was founded. From the birth of our nation until today, millions of Americans have fought and died for a very specific set of values that we used to abide by, and so many of us have given their lives to protect. These values included having a judicial branch that made all of the judicial decisions and decided who lives and who dies based on transparent due process. And these values included the U.S. military never turning its guns on U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. We must return to these values. And to do that, we need to undo parts of the National Defense Authorization Act and the Patriot Act that gave extrajudicial killing powers to the executive branch. Here's the simple summary. America was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. Dick Cheney and George W. Bush made us the land of the observed and the home of the cowardly. I think it's time to go back to land of the free and home of the brave. Ben Franklin said anyone who would surrender a little essential liberty for a small amount of security deserves neither. It's time to once again become the land of the free and the home of the brave. Say, we're not afraid. Our president is constrained by the laws of the land. If a court, using a transparent due process, says that the executive branch can put somebody to death, then, you know, I mean, they run the federal prisons, the executive branch. They do, you know, it was the executive branch. It was the president who executed Tim McVeigh. That was during, what, Clinton's time or Bush's time? I think it was Clinton's. Whatever. I mean, you know, this is a federal execution. Fine. Okay, the president has the power to execute people. But he shouldn't have and doesn't have. I mean, the Constitution does not give the president the power to say, you're the guy that we're going to execute. That's for the courts. This is something called due process. Excuse me. Another sneeze. My apologies. And, you know, I mean, in addition to being in the Constitution, it's also in the amendments to the Constitution. Due process is enshrined in the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th amendments to the Constitution as well. The right to a speedy trial, the right to make bail, the right to face your accusers, the 4th Amendment, the right to have the evidence against you gathered in a way that somebody swore that it was that. This is pretty straightforward stuff. We need to go back to it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, I understand to a large extent Rand Paul is out there grandstanding, and he's doing it for political gain, and he wants to run for president, the Libertarian Party. I know all that, but still there's a point here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, I guess you've got my take on this. I get it that Rand Paul and you know, Mike Lee and crazy Ted Cruz, you know, the these guys are all, you know, they're grandstanding around this issue. They're using it to get as much publicity as they can. But there is a core concept at the kernel of this that needs to be addressed. And this is the path that Bush and Cheney put this nation on, which is extrajudicial torture, extrajudicial killing, the right of the White House, the right of the executive branch of government to be judge, jury, and executioner. Our Constitution makes them the executioner, right? I'm down with that. I understand that. Somebody's got to run the prisons, and if we're going to be a nation that kills people, somebody's got to kill people. As much as I disagree with capital punishment, you know, let's not divert the argument. That's the job of the executive branch. But the job of deciding who gets killed or the job of deciding who gets imprisoned, that's the judicial branch of government. That's a third branch of government. It's the third of the three. It's not the job of the second of the three, the executive branch. Corky, you want to disagree with me? Hey, Corky, what's up?
No, I don't want to disagree with you. I think you'll agree with me.
Okay.
The president stood up there and took the oath of office, and he said, I will defend the United States against enemies, both domestic and foreign. Correct?
No, I don't believe so. I believe that is the oath that's taken by people in the military. And the oath that the president took was to defend the Constitution of the United States. In fact, I can read you the exact oath from the Constitution.
Well, that's what he's using. Drones are military. If you've got a militia group who are threatening the government of a state, of the nation, then he has the right to protect us against them.
Now, this is the oath that the president says. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, period, end of sentence, end of quotation mark, full stop. That's it, right out of the Constitution, verbatim, word for word, Corky. It does not say anywhere that it's the job of the president to protect the citizens of the United States. It's only the job of the president to protect the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, and who's the Constitution supposed to protect? The people?
Well, you can debate that. Howard Zinn would have told you that the Constitution was designed to protect rich white guys. Whatever it may be, the fact of the matter is that in his capacity as commander in chief, when Congress has determined that we are in a time of war, he has the authority to command the military, and the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force. He has the authority to command the military in order to defend us. But he is not, and he has the power, you know, using the FBI and other investigative agencies to determine who might be involved in criminal activity and to even try to prosecute them. But they have to prosecute them in front of a judge. And the judges are from the third branch of government, the judiciary. And the judiciary makes the decision about who goes to jail and who lives and dies. Not the second branch of government, not the executive branch, not the president.
Well, these militias that they're creating in Virginia and Arkansas and Mississippi, can't we consider them terrorists?
No. First of all, nobody, to the best of my knowledge, there is no state that has officially created a militia. We do have state militias. They're called National Guards. There may be, there's been legislation introduced in a couple of states to create so-called militias. And, you know, functionally, you know, either they're a joke or political grandstanding, or they're, let's rename our National Guard the state militia.
I understand what I'm talking about. I'm talking about these militias that get out in the woods and they swear an oath to each other and they play war games.
Right.
Now, war games are for one purpose, okay. One purpose only.
You're talking about the so-called patriot groups. You're talking about the...
Yes.
Okay,
I got it. When they threaten the government,
right,
an established government,
right,
then they are, in fact, an enemy of the state.
No, they are, in fact... Well, you could argue that, but what they're really doing is committing a crime. And they need to be arrested and taken before a judge, and the judge needs to determine how they are disposed of. Are they sent to jail? Are they given probation? Are they, 60 hours community service? Or are they put to death? I mean, whatever it may be. But it is not the president's call. It is the judge's call. We have a system of checks and balances in this country. Congress makes the law. The law will define what the parameters of that punishment can be. Congress makes the law. The executive branch determines who's breaking the law, at least in their opinion, and then they take that to the judges, and the judges, in the context of the law, in the context of the laws established by the legislative branch, branch one, looks at the alleged crimes of these people, which branch two, the executive branch, is saying this is what they did, and branch three, the judiciary, says, okay, we agree with or we disagree with the charges against these people, and here's the penalty, or we're letting them go. And what I'm saying is this, we can kill people inside the United States where the executive branch stuff that Eric Holder just laid out is, and basically it's just an extension of the Bush Doctrine, is the antithesis of what the Constitution says, because it cuts the judiciary out of the loop. Am I making sense here, Corky?
Somewhat, but I don't think you're following my train of thought.
Well, I think your train of thought, if I can recharacterize it, is something like there's nasty people out there who are trying to hurt us and trying to take down our government, and the president should have the power to do something about it. That's what you're saying, right?
That's my point. And the president swore an oath to protect us from that.
No, he didn't. He swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. The Constitution says that a judge has to make the final decision. You know, I don't have a problem with the executive branch, with the FBI, finding people who are, out in the woods running around practicing guns and have decided that they're going to try and, have a shootout with the state police or something. I got no problem with the FBI taking those people down, taking them to jail, charging them with crimes. But then they've got to be put before a judge before they are executed. Pardon?
When you have an army of people with AK-47s. And you send in the FBI. How many FBIs you got to send in to take down an army?
We got a hell of a lot of FBI guys. We've got a lot of military guys, or a lot of police. The police power of this nation is, frankly, much larger than I think it is, than I'm sorry. Well, I just got distracted.
I grew up with the understanding that you don't change the government by going out in the woods with your guns and practicing. My opinion of changing the government is going to the ballot box and voting.
I agree with you. I agree with you. The one area where I think we're disagreeing, and maybe we're not, is I'm saying that the power to determine who lives and dies, the power to determine who goes to prison and who doesn't go to prison, and the lives and dies part is the most relevant part here, because that's what Rand Paul is standing on the floor of the Senate right now ranting about, is the claimed power by the president to execute somebody from the air using a drone. And you know, that power is a power which is given to the third branch of government in the Constitution, to the judiciary. It is not given to the second branch of government, the executive. It is not given to the president. It is not given to the attorney general. They can ask for it. They can say, this guy is a bad guy, and we can, or these 50 guys with their AK-47s in the backwoods of you know, Flint, Michigan or whatever. These guys, these are the bad guys. But a judge has to make the final determination. And when you have one person or one branch of government, which is both prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, you have ceased to be the United States of America, at least as defined by our Constitution. And that's my point, Quirky. And thank you very much for calling. But, I just have to say, that's my point. Larry doesn't say where you're calling from. Larry, what's up? Where are you calling?
I'm calling from the state of Washington, Central Park.
Cool. What's up?
First of all, I'd like to say that Rand Paul is a fraud, and you can't cherry pick the parts of the libertarian movement that you're going to. I mean, he's a fraud.
Yeah, I acknowledge that. I said he's grandstanding in that, and that's why I want to talk about the issue rather than about Rand Paul.
Right. What I want to talk about is the topic of ammunition. You touched on it earlier, and here's what's happened in Washington State. I'm a member of law enforcement and have been for almost the last 10 years. And ammunition has become so scarce in my state that my department has had to postpone range qualifying because we can't get enough practice ammo.
Wow. And this is because people are hoarding bullets, basically.
Mm-hmm. You go to the local Walmart, and they haven't had any pistol ammo of any caliber for the last month and a half.
Wow. You wonder if the ammunition manufacturers are pulling a oil industry thing, you know, if they're withholding inventory from the marketplace in order to drive the prices up or in order to whip up hysteria or something. So that's pretty amazing. So that was the situation in 2009, just a few months after the president became president, too, that I encountered in that gun shop in Michigan. And I've been going back to Michigan since I was a kid. I mean, for years and years and years, my brother and I have been going to that gun shop, using their gun range, and buying their ammunition. And I've never seen anything like this. And until they went crazy about Obama.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And like I said, the essential message that we were told was there's a black guy in the White House and he wants to take away all our white people's guns. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Reading Bob Ney's new book, Sideswiped, Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen off Capitol Hill. I got to tell you, what's making news about Bob Ney's new book is that he says in it that John Boehner offered him a job if he would resign from Congress. He resigned, and that Boehner would make all the charges against him go away. He was involved in the whole Abramoff scandal. And then Boehner, as soon as he resigned, Boehner stopped taking his calls and didn't help him out and didn't give him a job and didn't do his legal defense fund and didn't make the charges go away, and Bob went to prison. And that's making the news. But I'm finding a lot of stuff. The last chapter of this book is about Don Siegelman. There's some amazing stuff in this book. Bob Ney, you know, the old Republican from Ohio, has become a real truth teller. It's book just came out today, so. And back third hour of our program today, we're going to have a fill-in host so that I can head over to the Monocle here, that's a nearby restaurant where Bob is doing a book signing thing, and I'm going to say a few kind words. I've gotten to know Bob over the years, and whole long story, but in any case, it's a fascinating time. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. John in Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, bring to your attention the Cuntel program. I'm sure you probably have heard of it.
Yeah, COINTELPRO. Yeah.
We actually murdered Fred Hampton. He was a Black Panther, and it was part of an operation by the Chicago police in coordination with COINTELPRO.
Right.
And
with the CIA.
You know, according to the Church Commission, this has gone on for quite a while, even before this program, all the way back to World War One. So, unfortunately, we really don't have a very good record when it comes to people being involved in.
But what came out of the Church Commission, John?
You know, I'm really not that familiar.
Okay, well, I was around at the time, and I can tell you what came out of the Church Commission. Well, what came out of the Church Commission was very specific rules that forbid the CIA from operating within the United States, that said that the FBI has to do domestic stuff, that forbid the government from having executions, either foreign or domestic.
Right.
And, you know, basically, after the abuses that were demonstrated during the Church Commission hearings, we tried to put that genie back in the bottle, and it's crept back out again.
But it just really, I guess it has never gone away. And I just wanted to make also one more point about search and seizure.
Yeah.
In this city and in Chicago, there was, groups of people that had just simply gone to South America and talked to people that were involved in left politics or guerrillas or whatever, just to understand what it was that they wanted and things of this sort. And they had their homes broken into recently, and that was under, you know, the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security. And the FBI is still, they're still at it. So, you know, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, we're just not making much progress, really. And we do need specific laws to prevent this, but I don't know that everybody agrees with that, apparently. You know, I mean, there's not a political will.
Well, this is the thing. What George Bush and Dick Cheney said to us is we need to be afraid and we need to go shopping. Don't pay any attention to what's going on politically. Just become goods consumers. You know, stop being politically active. Stop caring about these things. And by the way, be afraid. We'll take care of everything. And they changed the name of our country from the United States of America to that word that Hitler changed Germany to. In Hitler's case, it was Heimat. Homeland in English, and I find it bizarre that Eric Holder is referring to the homeland to protect the homeland here in his letter. We don't have a homeland. We are not the genetic people. You know, arguably the Native Americans can refer to North America as their homeland, but you know, for the rest of us, I don't think so. In any case, John, thanks for the call. Josh in Rocky Springs, West Virginia. Do I have that right? Rock Spring?
It's Rock Springs, Wyoming.
Tom. Oh, Wyoming. I saw the W and then it kind of trailed off. Okay. So, what's up?
Yeah, well, I used to disagree with you about the drone program until common sense hit me in the face. And I realized, you know, I'm tired of being afraid.
Yeah.
I grew up during the Bush-Cheney fear everything type. Fear everything program.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, you know, you're right. Why should the executive branch have the authority to kill people?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
Well, or to determine who gets killed. I mean, they should have the authority to kill people if we decide as a country that we're going to kill people. If we're going to authorize the executive branch, if we're going to go to war, the executive branch has to lead us to war. If we're going to have federal executions, the executive branch does it. But the determination of who to kill, if it's war, that is up to Congress. And if it is crime, that is up to the judiciary.
That's right.
Yeah. Pardon my splitting hairs, but I think it's important to keep these things straight. So, Josh, thank you. Thank you for common sense. Appreciate the call. George in Franklin, North Carolina. Hey, George, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Hartman. I know you are busy today.
Yeah.
I like several of the points you've made, especially about the crazy crackpots with the guns and how now they've got a legitimate argument. But I just wanted to point this out to you. I'm kind of monitoring C-SPAN and you and watching the Internet, and there's a gambling line on whether or not the filibuster will outlast the Senate. I don't know how long they have to go, but it started out, the odds were 7-1, when Cruz and a senator from Kansas, that I can't remember his name, rose in support and giving him breaks, what have you. It jumped to 7-3. Ron Wyden just took the floor. It looks like he's going to be talking for 5 or 10 minutes. The odds just jumped 7-4.
Wow.
I thought I'd point that out to you.
Very interesting.
Personally,
his odds over at Intrade?
Or not, I'm on his side. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Are the odds over at Intrade? Is that where you're seeing this stuff?
It's a little gambling page on the Internet.
Ah, okay. All right. That's fascinating.
It's coming out of England.
Yeah, yeah. Intrade's out of Ireland, but there's a bunch of them. That's fascinating. George, thanks for calling and sharing that. I appreciate it. Charles in Atlanta. Hey. Oh, I'm sorry. Charles, we're going to have to continue our conversation a little bit. We just hit the music, which means I got to shut up and we got to get ready for the news and give all of our listeners who are listening to our commercial stations an opportunity to support their local station by supporting their advertisers and those who are watching Free Speech TV an opportunity to call in and pledge the fund drive. And if you're listening to a nonprofit station, help them out. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. Glad to have you with us. And you will recall back in 2002, 2003, a very strong case was made for a war with Iraq against Saddam Hussein. One of the folks involved in making that case was Douglas Feith. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and director of the Center for National Security Strategies, the author of the book War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon and the Dawn of the War on Terrorism, Hudson.org, the website for the Hudson Institute. Douglas Feith, welcome to the program.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us. What, if I may, just to kind of start this thing out, what in your mind, in retrospect, was the, do you have any concerns or regrets about our nation having gone to war with Iraq?
Well, I think that the rationale for the war was strong. Naturally, one has regrets about various mistakes that got made, but I think fundamentally the president made the right decision that removing Saddam Hussein from power was important and valuable, and the risks of leaving him in power were very substantial.
And yet Saddam Hussein was the principal enemy of the Iranians. You know, he had lost a million people. The Iranians had lost a million people in the war between Iraq and Iran. And he was our Sunni bulwark against that Shiite force. Bob Ney, the former congressman who got, you know, taken down in the Jack Abramoff scandal, he's got a new book out, just literally came out today. It's called Sideswiped. And in his book, he talks about sitting in the with Fouad El-Zayat, who was basically an arms dealer, I guess. You know, he made airplanes, but, you know, weapons of war. And he was meeting with Bob Ney in London, discussing Boeing and other contracts that had to do with Iran. And they were in the Ambassador Club dining room, this private club. And if I can just share a couple sentences with you, I'd like to get your take on this. He said, Fouad turned to me and said something was burned into my brain. He pointed at two men who were sitting at the table near us, involved in an intense conversation. He said, "Do you see those two men?" He said, "Do you recognize them?" And Bob says, "I knew one of them. The man was the to the left is King Hussein of Jordan's brother, the crown prince, but I didn't know the other guy." And Fouad replies in a very calm but firm tone, "That other man, not King Hussein's brother, but the man sitting with him." He said, "This man will lie to your country. This man will catch the ear of your president. This man is a wanted criminal in Jordan, yet he sits with the king's brother here in London. This man is here in London carrying out one of the biggest schemes in modern history, and this man will soon take your country into war in Iraq. His name is Ahmed Chalabi. Do you think it's possible that you and all the other guys in the Bush administration were conned by the Iranian government through their agent Ahmad Chalabi into taking out their principal enemy Saddam Hussein on their behalf?
No, I don't think that analysis is right. I think it's wrong in a number of respects. I don't think that the decision making in the U.S. government was driven by Chalabi or any other one guy. I don't think that that the United States was conned. It was not a con that Saddam Hussein was a very dangerous guy.
Oh, come on. He was writing a novel about a romance novel. He had no weapons of mass destruction.
Well, it's not true that he had no weapons of mass destruction. He not only had weapons of mass destruction, he had used them against the Kurds in northern Iraq. He had used them against Iran. Saddam was the first person in history to use nerve gas on the battlefield.
And we just, modern nerve gas. Yeah, I was thinking of World War One, but you know, the UN went in, they took that stuff out, they destroyed it. The weapons inspectors said it's not there anymore.
No, that's not what the weapons inspector said. I mean, I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about the whole weapons of mass destruction issue and programs in Iraq. If your listeners are interested in the facts on this, what I would urge them to do is, on the internet, you can get the report of the Iraq Survey Group, which was a bunch of intelligence officials sent in by Australia, Britain, and the United States after Saddam's removal. And they issued a 3-volume report, which is available on the internet, that explained the status of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. And Iraq was a country that had substantial weapons of mass destruction programs. The big mistake that was made by our intelligence services before the war was the belief that Saddam was maintaining chemical and biological weapons stockpiles. That was a gigantic mistake.
But there are other countries who have those stockpiles. We have those stockpiles. If they're not intending to use them against us, and I don't recall any specific evidence that Saddam was coming against us or against our direct interests, why did we do what Iran wanted and take him out?
Saddam was very hostile to us. We had fought a war against him in 1990-91 when Iraq had invaded Kuwait.
Right, after April Gillespie told him he could. Right.
And the UN, with American support, had put in place a set of containment measures. Among those were no-fly zones in northern and southern Iraq that were patrolled by American British aircraft. And Saddam, when the Bush administration came into office, was shooting at those aircraft on a daily basis. When the Bush administration came into office, the only place in the world where American forces were being fired at every day, virtually, was over Iraq.
No, it was the only place where we were enforcing a no-fly zone.
Okay, but your point that he had no hostility to us or was not of concern to us is just wrong. And
if we had been ignoring him, wait, hang on just a second, Doug. If we had said we're going to deal with Saddam Hussein the same way that we deal with Robert Mugabe, we're going to let him kill his own people, do you think he would have been shooting at us?
But it wasn't just his own people. The reason we were patrolling those no-fly zones was he had started an international war against Iran. He fought that for 8 years, and as you rightly pointed out, around 1 million people were killed.
And we supported both sides in that war.
And then, 2 years later, he invaded Kuwait. So it's not true that he was a danger only to his own people. He invaded Kuwait and was then threatening Saudi Arabia.
Well, he invaded Kuwait, he said.
Hang on 1 second. And in the course of the war, where we threw Iraqi forces out of Kuwait, he fired rockets at both Saudi Arabia and Israel. So your point that he was a threat only to his own people is not correct. Tom, what I would say is this. I certainly understand and respect people who argue that in balancing the risks of leaving Saddam Hussein in power or removing him by force, President Bush made the wrong decision. Okay, I think he made the right decision, but I certainly understand that there are reasonable people who could strike that balance differently.
Mm-hmm.
But the argument that Saddam Hussein was not a threat to us, that we were not worried about him, that he didn't have WMD programs, that the whole thing was made up, is an argument that is not accurate. It's not based on the facts.
Okay. Douglas Feith, Hudson.org. Mr. Feith, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Good to talk.
Good speaking with you. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll do that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. Stick around. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. Don't tell Limbaugh. It doesn't lead to stiff thinking, but he'll want some. Anyhow. Rama in Vermont. Hey, Rama. What's up?
How you doing, Tom?
I am great.
Hey, listen,
I'm the very first producer, Rama. How you doing?
Well, thank you. Actually, it was one of the best things I ever did in my life was being able to do some work for you for a while.
You helped us kick off this show. So what's on your mind today, Rama?
Well, you know, when Douglas Feith there, as he mentioned the Iraqi survey group and implied that they found some stuff in Iraq. Understand, I mean, it's so bad that we have to keep revisiting history. David Kaye, who headed up the Iraqi survey group, when asked about the possibility of WMDs being taken out of Iraq and into Syria, said it couldn't happen. It couldn't happen because Iraq did not have the production capability to make any WMD, and therefore that's how they knew he didn't have any in the country, and that's how they knew he couldn't smuggle any out of the country.
Right.
So, and Douglas Feith, at the position he is in, knows this. And he read the report. He said he did, at least. I know I did read the report, and I know that David Kaye did not say anything of the sort that Iraq had those weapons of mass destruction.
Well, Doug Feith was very careful not to say that the report said that there were weapons of mass destruction. He said it described Saddam Hussein's WMD programs. Now, that would be
right
over a long period of time. It was probably the historical part of the document.
Absolutely, but here's what he also kept going back and saying, because this is like pulling an acorn on everybody, is he kept good. Feith went back a couple times and made mention of the fact that, oh, he did do this, the past tense, before they got in there and made up all that stuff to invade. So, you know, I don't blame you for not calling him out on the carpet for it, but it's important. I just wanted to, you know, look, I was alive and well and sentient human being during those days.
Yeah, so
I know the lies we were told. I was very involved.
Well, I couldn't call him on the Iraq survey group because, unlike you, Rama, I have not read the report. So, you know, but I figured, you know, the report has a history, but I do remember David Kaye coming out and saying there's nothing here. And I remember when he went over there saying, I don't think there's anything here. And certainly we had Scott Ritter saying there's definitely nothing there. I was there.
Yep.
And so
Flix was saying there's nothing there.
Yeah, yeah. So
everybody was saying there's nothing there but the Bush administration.
Yeah, and you know, I'd like to continue that conversation with Doug Feith. It's a shame we have so little time in radio. I wanted to get into clearly he doesn't think this is a war crime, so he doesn't think anybody should go to jail, but B, George W. Bush saying before he was even elected, that if he got a chance to go to war with Iraq, he would do it so that he could gain political capital. And I wonder if Feith feels used by that, although he was one of the guys who signed the 1998 PNAC thing asking Clinton to invade Iraq. So I'm guessing he's been gung-ho against Iraq
This is what makes your show so valuable, because you do provide some historical context. So when, you know, I mean, right now it's like you were talking about, what's his name there?
Ahmed Chalabi?
No, the senator.
The church committee, Frank Church.
No.
Another one.
Who was doing the bit about on the floor about Obama.
Oh, Rand Paul, yeah.
Rand Paul, thank you.
You're welcome.
Because he wants to pretend like there was no history before today, and all of a sudden it's Obama coming out with these policies.
Well, yeah, that's because Rand Paul is going to, you know, this is Rand Paul launching his run for president on the Libertarian ticket, or maybe on the Republican ticket. He's going to, you know, like his dad did, he's going to become the perennial Republican presidential candidate. It's the family business. But there's more to it than that. Rahm, I got to move along. Got a lot of calls. Thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Calvin in San Antonio. Hey, Calvin.
Hey, Tom. It's a lot of guys like Douglas Feith and a lot of like the Bushes who will sit and want to go to war, but they don't want to fight. They're sitting there criticized, but they never fight in these wars. They can always send us. I was in Desert Storm. I feel I have a leg to stand on because I did go to war for this country. Right. Mr. Feith sounds like he's around my age, and he could have fought. He could have signed up, enlisted, and did a lot of things and went over there and fought for us, but he didn't.
Right. Yeah, I don't know any of the neocons who served in the military. And again, Doug Feith is not here to defend himself. I don't want to turn this into a let's bash Doug Feith thing.
Right.
But that said, the cautious voices in the Bush administration were Lawrence Wilkerson and Colin Powell, two men who had seen people die on the field of battle. And I think history demonstrates that not always, but more often than not, the Dwight Eisenhowers and the Colin Powells of the world, people who have seen people die, people who have ordered people into combat where they died, are far more cautious about rushing into a war than people who have only seen wars on, in cartoon shows or in the movies. And I think your point is an excellent point. Thank you very much for calling and making it, Calvin. And thank you for your service to your country. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. We warned about the overreach of presidential power during the Cheney administration.
Yes.
And what we said is, hey, in consideration of any government power, what happens when power changes hands? Are you willing to grant this power to those who you don't trust? So think about the presidential candidates who ran last time. Would you want Rick Perry, Newt Gingrich, or Michelle Bachmann to have this power? Would you trust them?
I don't.
So we always have to...
Oh, in other words, what you're suggesting is that when anybody defends the policy, the Bush-Obama policy of, we can even kill Americans on American soil with drones from the sky, when anybody defends that policy, you should say... Really, would you feel that same way if Michelle Bachmann was president of the United States? Would you feel that same way if Newt Gingrich was president of the United States? Would you feel that same way? I mean, can you reach back into history if George Wallace was president of the United States?
Yeah, and so during the Bush-Cheney years, we were saying that to those people then. Would you trust it when there's a Democrat or another party in power that you don't trust?
Yeah.
You've always got to consider what happens when, quote, the other side, I don't like that term, but when somebody who you don't trust gets into power.
Yeah. Excellent.
We've got to be always see the future when somebody, when things don't go the way we want them to.
Yeah, very, very well said, Jeff. And that's the ultimate litmus test. Pardon my hiccup here. Hang on just a second. Jeff, thank you very much for the call. This is the bottom line for this whole thing. Is it the right thing under the Constitution? The Fifth Amendment says not only can, if you're going to kill somebody, not only can you not have the executive branch make that decision, the legislative branch, not only can the judicial branch have to make it, but it has to be made by a grand jury.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Read the Fifth Amendment. In capital cases, in other words, if somebody's going to be executed, only a jury can make the decision, not the president. Find the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Richard in North Carolina watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom. The subject I'm seeing on TV now is Saddam Hussein.
Mm.
In row six, I bought a book written by George Sada with Jim Nelson Black called Saddam's Secrets. And in it, this guy was a general and Saddam's staff. He was head of the Air Force. He was the only Assyrian Christian on the staff. And he clearly states that he used American-made 747s and 727s with 56 sorties to Syria and other countries to carry all of Saddam Hussein's WMDs, which included nuclear, chemical, and biological.
Yeah, I've heard these allegations. The Iraq study group actually said, no, not possible, because he didn't have this stuff. There's no evidence of where it might have been stored before it was moved. The Iraq Study Group concluded that that was simply not the case. Somebody might be claiming it. Somebody might have written a book about it. Doesn't make it so.
He was touted on many media, and suddenly he disappeared. But
could be that suddenly he disappeared because he was just, you know, he was full of it.
Well, that I don't know.
Yeah.
Because
there were a lot of people, you know, running around trying to make this thing right. You know, this, but the thing that haunts me, and Shano, if you can find that clip of Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers Commission, before the House of Representatives, the thing that haunts me is George W. Bush, a year before the presidential election, saying to Mickey Herskowitz, the guy that his dad had hired to write, to ghostwrite his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, which you can read in the bookstores now, in the 100 or so hours of audio tape where Herskowitz, you know, had these interviews with George W. Bush. George W. Bush, according to Herskowitz, speaking to a reporter, to Robert Perry, said this.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. So this was George Bush's, and this was in 1999. This was a year before he even became president. In fact, you know, according to two different cabinet members who were there, the first item of business in the first Bush cabinet meeting back in January of 2001 was, how do we get Saddam? Hello?
Yes.
So Richard, I'm telling you, this, you know, George Bush was obsessed with this thing. He thought that this was the way to privatize Social Security, was to get enough political capital by being a wartime president.
Well, thank God I'm on Social Security because I lost everything in 08,
mm-hmm.
pretty much everything.
Yeah.
And it seems like a pall of greed and deceit has fallen on America in the last 10 years.
Yep.
I've said before, and I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
But the point was, Saddam attacked Kuwait to get into Saudi Arabia's oil. And we stopped him as we
maybe, should. Maybe not. Saddam said to the world that he was attacking Kuwait because Kuwait was slant drilling underneath their border into his oil pools. And he thought that was wrong. Kuwait had historically been part of Iraq. It was like the 37th district or some 38th district. It was like a former state of Iraq. And he asked April Gillespie, asked the Assistant Secretary of State, you know, is America going to get involved if I take back my state? And we apparently said, no, we're not going to get involved. So he went ahead thinking that he basically had our approval. We had been supporting him in the war against Iran. We had been providing Saddam with, you know, he had WMD at that point in time because we sold it to him. Don Rumsfeld went over and sold it to him when he was working for the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. I mean, for the Nixon administration.
Right. The book shows he has $11 billion from the United States in his personal account.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he has a lot of money. I mean, you know, we were big supporters of Saddam Hussein because he was the barrier against Iran. And then Ahmad Shalabi comes along and says, oh, yeah, you got to take out Saddam. And George, that's all George wanted to hear. And I am convinced to this day that Ahmad Shalabi was an agent of the Iranians. I mean, what was the very first business to open in Iraq after we finally, you know, got ourselves out of there? The National Bank of Iran opened in downtown Baghdad. It was the very first business, major business. Richard, thanks for the call. Mike in Renton, Washington. Hey, Mike, thanks for listening to 91.3. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I usually agree with you, but I have to disagree with you about targeting U.S. citizens on the U.S. soil, and that our country has a tradition of putting down rebellions, and that actually, like the Shays Rebellion under the Confederation was one of the reasons why we formed a constitution and to be able to suppress rebellions internally.
Sure. I don't disagree, but the point is that This is not this is not about rebellion. And I mean, we litigated that with the Civil War. And B, all I'm saying is involve a judge. And in fact, not the founders were even more explicit than that. Let me just read this to you. This is the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. And they said, this is the very first sentence of the Fifth Amendment. And they're talking capital case, of course, is somebody who might be executed, okay? So, you know, before you drop a drone on somebody's head, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Now, in other words, they said it's got to be with the people. It's got to be, you know, a jury of your peers, basically. Even a judge can't order the execution of somebody. A jury has to do it. And I think that's pretty serious stuff. And when you and the judiciary is the third branch of government. It's a separate branch of government from the executive branch, the presidency. And when the president decides to become the jury as well as the executioner, whether it's George Bush who started this whole thing or Barack Obama who's continuing it, I think they're in error. I think they're wrong.
Okay. Well, I think it's it's a tool in the your toolbox.
Well, that's fine. Have a legal procedure. You can have secret grand juries. Have a jury that the executive branch goes before and says, you know, okay, to this top secret, you know, grand jury says, here's the case to be made for killing this guy with a drone from the sky or for killing this guy with a poison point umbrella. I don't care what it is. Here's the case to be made for executing this guy, you know, outside of the death chamber the way we did with Tim McVeigh. And the grand jury looks over the information and says, you know, and holds some sort of a proceeding where that person is allowed a defense, whether it's themselves or whether it's, you know, in absentia, you know, like the guy who was in Libya or Syria or wherever he was when we dropped the drone on him. That there should be some kind of a defense presented before somebody's executed. I'm just saying due process.
Yeah. But most of that's going to be done in secret anyway, right?
It's going to be done in secret. I don't have a problem with it being done in secret. I just want it done. And what the executive branch has been asserting since George W. Bush is that the president has the power to be the judge and the jury as well as the executioner. The executioner part, that's in the Constitution, arguably. But the judge and jury part, that's to the judiciary. That's Article 3 of the Constitution, not Article 2 of the Constitution. And that is overreach.
Yeah, well, I think the drones are just part of the execution part.
I agree. And if you want to use a drone to kill somebody and you have and there has been due process involved in it, then, you know, I'm not happy about it, but I will acknowledge that it is constitutional. What I'm concerned about is that we are leaving behind basic core constitutional principles. We've left behind so many of the Fourth Amendment ones. Now we're leaving behind the Fifth through the Eighth Amendment ones.
So you'd agree with Holder that there are circumstances where we would use drones to target U.S. citizens.
Well, Holder didn't actually make that. He made that statement, but the defense that he made was essentially, if I'm reading the letter right, that if he could have shot out of the air the 9/11 planes before they hit the towers, or if he could have shot out of the air the Japanese fleet before it hit Pearl Harbor, that he would have done that. Well, I think you could argue that the Japanese fleet coming to hit Pearl Harbor, even if you don't have time for Congress to act, it's probably within the power of the White House, of the presidency, to use the military to stop that. And with regard to shooting one of those airplanes out of the sky, maybe that power exists. But that's, you know, without a judicial process, because there's an imminent danger to a large...
Tim McVeigh.
Say what?
How about the next Tim McVeigh?
Well, you know, Tim McVeigh was taken before a jury. He was convicted.
I mean, but to try to preempt something like that.
Well, that's, you know, that's why the FBI infiltrates groups. That's why, I mean, we've had all these groups broken up. That's called good old-fashioned police work.
Well, I agree that we have to come to consensus about using them, but I don't want to get rid of tools in the tool shed.
Oh, that's never going to happen. I mean, you know, drones are just the modern-day version of helicopters, which are just the modern-day version of airplanes, which are just a fancier way of delivering a bomb than throwing it with a cannon, which is a fancier version of doing it with a catapult. which, you know, started out with a slingshot and David and Goliath. I mean, you can draw a straight line. You know, the technology is not going to go away. Mike, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So should the president be able to be the judge, jury, and executioner? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very ramiferously ugly. The good. Flipper and friends, when Karen Getchum and her dog found themselves stuck on an ocean current off the coast of South Australia, they thought all was lost. But not to fear, their Cetacean friends were near. A pack of dolphins formed a protective ring around Getchum and her dog, pushing them to shore, saving her from drowning or worse, becoming shark bait. Seas around Australia are home to some of the world's most endangered dolphin species. Fishing nets and pollution have taken their toll on the snub-fin dolphin population in particular. There are only around 1,000 left in the wild. It's certainly encouraging to see our ocean-dwelling friends show some mammal solidarity even as we destroy their homes. If only we could be so good. The bad. Nelson City, Georgia. You get a gun. You get a gun. Everybody gets a gun. In a move that would make Oprah blush, Nelson City, Georgia wants to make gun ownership mandatory within its city limits. Even though there's no proof that more guns leads to less violence, most evidence actually suggests the opposite. Nelson City Councilman Dwayne Chronic, really, Chronic, is convinced that if passed, the gun mandate will, quote, tell the potential intruder, you better think twice. The only nation with a higher number of guns per capita than the U.S., Yemen, where Islamist militias hold sway over much of the country. Right, because out-arming a war zone is just the thing to cut down on crime. Nelson City, your logic's just bad. And the ugly. HIV rates. Surprise, surprise, HIV is most concentrated in states that don't teach safe sex in public schools. Center for Disease Control's most recent HIV surveillance report shows a wide swath of AIDS-infected areas cutting across the Bible Belt. Yes, some northern states like New York and Massachusetts have higher than average infection rates, but don't mistake their political liberalism for good sex ed policies. Massachusetts public schools don't have to teach sex ed or HIV safety. New York schools teach their students about HIV, but don't enforce any form of sexual education. In this day and age, it should be clear. Honest education is the best way to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS. The fact that even our most liberal states can't recognize this is just plain ugly. Yeah. Jack in San Francisco. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind?
Yeah, when you were talking about the Iraq war and it all going back to April Gillespie and James Baker giving the go-ahead for Saddam to clear things up, the right before that, I mean, you know, he was, of course, Rumsfeld called him our best friend in the region, and we were helping him get the weapons, and I think
we were selling him weapons.
We were selling him weapons, and we even voted against a UN resolution that was condemning him for using chemical weapons.
Yeah,
I mean we were so far on his side, and the when the invasion of Kuwait happened, do you remember there was those deceptions that came along with it, where the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter was went up before Congress and she wept and told a
pretended
lie
to be
about,
a nurse. They're throwing babies out of the incubators for the preemies, and it was an absolute lie. Yep, we were sold that war too.
There was multiple deceptions, and so my point is, I wonder, because Saddam had decided to sell his oil. Of course, our main concern was controlling the flow of oil in Iraq. And he all of a sudden made the decision to use euro dollars, euro petrodollars, rather than U.S. petrodollars. And that the invasion of Kuwait, when that happened, they saw it as an opportunity to move towards regime change, since Saddam had made this decision to suddenly break the rules that we had set for him regarding the flow of Iraqi oil.
Could be. I think the big crime that Saddam committed by going into Kuwait was adding to his oil capacity, because as Dick Cheney famously told us, Iraq has 20 or 10% of the world's oil reserves. very significant. Well, I'll let Dick Cheney tell you. Here he is.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And when he adds Kuwait's to it, he might even have more than Saudi Arabia. And do we really want a guy who puts a picture of George Herbert Walker Bush on the front, on the front entryway, that you have to walk over the guy's face to walk into the biggest hotel in Baghdad? I mean, that was the perpetual insult that George W. would refer to. It really, really upset the Bush family.
But the main impetus there was to take control of whatever oil there was in the region, the flow of oil, and that was really at the root of everything that led up to, you know, eventually.
I agree. And you can take that back to Reagan's decision to undo Jimmy Carter's policies that would have made us independent of foreign oil. Back in 1978 and 79, Carter put into place all these incentive programs for solar and wind power was talking about cap and trade or carbon taxes, ways to increase the price of oil and put this country in the direction of, in fact, Carter said a famous speech. I've played it many times on this program. He said this country will never, ever again import more foreign oil than we did in 1978. Never. And,
That was
Reagan blew that up.
Bush family. The Bush family needed to have, they saw their interests being directly related to how Iran affected the oil markets.
And the Carlyle Group, you know, which is big in defense contractors. Hey, war makes a lot of money.
Yeah.
I want to get one more call in here before we get just a little less than a minute. Dylan in New York City. Hey, Dylan, what's up?
How are you? Yes, actually, very interesting. We're talking Iraq. Madam Albright actually was interviewed by Leslie Stahl in 1996, I believe, and she was asked, half a million children died due to the
embargoes,
sanctions on Iraq.
Yeah, the sanctions. Yeah.
And Madam Albright said, I believe it was worth it. These videos on YouTube, I believe it was worth it.
Yeah.
That even though more children were lost in Hiroshima and Nagasaki due to the sanctions.
Yeah, and that was the policy of the Clinton administration, although it was continued by the Bush administration. And it was a policy that was started by the first Bush administration. And I think in the case of Madeleine Albright, that was, you know, what else is she going to say? Yes, you know, I'm a mass murderer? I don't think so. Welcome to Human Nature. Mike Newcomb up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back, everybody, for hour number three. We're throwing you a little curveball today, though. You got the good doctor here for hour number three, so I appreciate the opportunity to help Tom out today. And as always, my friends, you know we like to get the Freedom Lines rocking and rolling. And Eric, since we're doing just 1 hour today,
I say
let the people speak.
Sure.
Sure. Are you okay with that?
I'm sure there's already plenty of callers who would love to say something.
Absolutely. So let me give you the number for the Freedom Lines right now. It's 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. That's 1-866-987-8466. And we can talk about anything. We do like a modified Bring It On Friday when we do the local show. So, what's today? Wednesday?
Today is...
Yes, Wednesday. Yes, Wednesday. So let's just call it a Bring It On Wednesday. So... anything you want to talk about is fair game. All you got to do is pick up the phone and call the Freedom Lines, the number I just given to you. But just to give you some teaser topics, just in case there's nothing coming right to the forefront of your mind, the sequester, Eric, is now in effect, and major cuts all across the board, even my field, medicine. We have a 2% cut in Medicare that went into effect immediately after midnight when the sequester finally took effect.
Does that upset you?
It doesn't, you know, well, look, nobody likes to get cut, right? I mean, but what upsets me is the fact that these Republicans continue to obstruct this president. I mean, the president has consistently reached out to them, and he's always said, too, look, I'll extend my hand if you unclench your fist. But the problem is, not only are they not unclenching their fists, they want to get into a brawl with the president, and they want to do that just because of their own selfish political interest at the expense of we the people. I mean, this sequester, look, I would give the example, again, using the doctor analogy, Eric, is if somebody has something wrong, say you got an ingrown toenail, or you know, you got gout in your big toe, what you do is you focus on
you
that.
You cut the foot off.
Right. Or in this case, they'll cut the leg off. Right. You know, and that's the Republican version of fiscal, you know, austerity. You know, we're just going to cut the whole damn thing off, and who cares what happens to the rest of the body? I mean, it's the axe approach versus, say, a scalpel. And I'm a fan of the scalpel because you do it with precision, you do it where it's appropriate, and you do it where it's the least painful, and you get the best possible outcomes. That's the way you should do a budget. But I am 100% convinced that these conservative Republicans are actually banking on the fact that if things get much worse, somehow or another, the public is going to try to blame Obama for this. When in reality, it's their intransigence, it's their inability to move forward in a compromising way, their recalcitrance, that's really causing the main problems. I saw one of the headlines in the internet today, Eric. It said, Obama GOP senators plan rare meal together. Now, I don't think they were talking about the steak when they're saying the rare meal. I think it's rare because it doesn't happen. And it begs the question, why? You know, why doesn't this happen? I distinctly remember a little while back when, you remember Obama invited all the Republican leaders to a conference, and he sat there at the table and fielded questions from every single one of them. And I think they were pretty embarrassed at that particular point because they didn't realize, you know, how brilliant this guy is, how intelligent he is, how he's able to just hold a moot court, if you will, in front of everybody extemporaneously and speak very eloquently and directly to the issues at hand. So that might very well be the reason why they don't want Obama to, you know, come to the table with them. So we'll see what happens. 10 senators, they're going to be meeting with Obama for a meal. I guess it's at the White House, and we'll see if they're able to find any compromise. But the sequester is going to hurt so many people on so many levels, and in particular, I was talking about the science aspect of this too, Eric. I don't know if you heard just the other day, there was a child that was born. I mean, I'm sure you know that a child was born the other day.
Yes.
Yes, that happens every day.
Every day.
But this
multiple times.
Yes, but this particular child was born with HIV. Apparently, from my understanding, I don't know all the exact details, but he was treated very quickly. The mother had HIV. It somehow or another got passed through the bloodstream. He was treated immediately, the child, and it turns out because of the aggressiveness and the alacrity with which they treated the child, the HIV virus basically showed up, for all intents and purposes, non-existent in the bloodstream. That kind of research often is conducted through, like, the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. And, again, we are going to be having draconian cuts to the science foundation of this country. And to me, that is just –
they hate science, Mike.
It's crazy. Well, look, the guy who was on the science committee, the conservative Republican, his name is escaping me now. He was the candidate, but the one who said about legitimate rape.
Right.
And he that guy who was offering up that quote unquote scientific theory about legitimate rape and a woman has a way to shut that thing down. Well, guess what? That guy heads the science committee. Yeah, Todd Akin was his name, if I'm not right, correct?
Todd Akin.
Yeah, Todd Akin. So Todd Akin actually has a position of leadership on the science committee. I mean, there couldn't be somebody more inept and incompetent to sit not only on the committee, but to be a leader on that committee. So this is going to really hurt, and as each and every day goes by, and as this sequester takes effect, it's going to be devastating, absolutely devastating to the people who really need those funds the most. So education funds, you got science funds, you got military budgets that are going to be cut drastically. And again, it's the axe versus the scalpel approach. And
they're cutting the janitors in Washington. You know, it's like, well, they need those guys the most.
No.
With all that trash talking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we got that on the table. If you want to talk about the sequester, we can do that. The other big issue, too, is now that Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, as we like to call it, is the law of the land, and it cannot be challenged. It's not going to be overridden. It's not going to be vetoed by the president himself. It's here, and it's here to stay. And now they're phasing in the various provisions of the the Affordable Care Act. Remember early on all these conservative governors saying, well, we don't want anything to do with Obamacare. We don't want them involved in our Medicaid and, you know, go take a hike. We want nothing to do with it. Well, under the Affordable Care Act for the next 3 years, Eric, what happens under the Medicaid side of it is that the federal government fully funds the entire program for the next 3 years. Right. And you had all these Republican governors and leaders saying, we want nothing to do with it prior to the election. You know, you could take your money and shove it for all we care. They would rather their citizens of their state, and in particular the poor people, go without health insurance. Well, now that Obama's been reelected, now that they know there's no chance of overturning it, you have about 8 governors in the country, GOP-led, you know, states, governors, who now have said, guess what? We'll accept the actual Medicaid expansion and the federal dollars. But only here in Arizona. Now, Jan Brewer, our governor, has actually changed her tune. She's now willing to accept the Medicaid dollars. But as you know, we have a lunatic state legislature here in Arizona, the most conservative, crazy legislators that you could ever imagine. They now are fighting the governor. They don't want this to happen. And that means like 50,000 people will actually lose health care coverage, or they'll have no access to health care coverage. So Jan Brewer was at the Capitol today with a bunch of doctors in white lab coats, and all of a sudden now she's a champion of the people.
She's a Democrat now?
Yeah, all of a sudden we must do this now. It just goes to show you how hypocritical they really are. But look, I give the governor credit in the sense that she wants to accept the Medicaid dollars.
Well, maybe she actually read something and figured out that it was the correct thing to do.
Who knows? Or maybe she wants to run for another office somewhere down the line and just get some more moderates and independents on board if she's actually able to convince the state legislature to change their tune. But right now, the state legislature here in Arizona is fighting that. So we got that. We got the Jody Arias trial here in our own backyard in Arizona. This is a national story. This is the girl who murdered her boyfriend and said she never did it, and she shot him in the head, then stabbed him 27 times.
She took pictures of his body?
Well, inadvertently. I think the camera fell. But that's a fascinating case that's going on live here in Maricopa County. So lots of things to talk about, my friends. The Freedom Lines are packed right now. Just give us a call at 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M, and we'll be back after this break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for the hour today. So to welcome everybody to the table. So, Eric, let's just get to the Freedom Lines. The lines are packed right now. So why don't we start off with, let's go with Michael. He's listening on Sirius Radio from Woodstock, Connecticut. Okay, and let's get Michael on the line. Michael, welcome to the table.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Listen, I'm calling about, I've been doing a lot of look on the Internet today regarding these hate group reports that have been coming out from the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Right.
And a great many of conservatives are actually listing the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group itself.
That's ridiculous.
Ironic twist.
That's ridiculous. I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center does great work, and they do a great job in actually profiling who these hate groups are. Look, we have tons of these hate groups out here in Arizona. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I remember the guy who killed his girlfriend.
Right. You did an interview with
JT Reddy.
JT Reddy. Yeah. He was one of those groups and ultimately ended up killing himself and
his girlfriend and her family.
Yeah. Crazy.
Well, I'm actually an attorney myself. I met Morris Dees way back in law school, and I found him to be a very compelling man. And the work that they're doing, the groups that they're listing, is just, they're just doing tremendous work. But a lot of conservatives, I mean mainstream conservatives, are saying that their list is Big Brother. It's political correctness. It's they're not targeting black groups. They're not targeting Hispanic groups. It's just an ironic twist. It's a very typical sort of conservative argument.
Yeah, but the conservatives are so receptive to the smallest level of propaganda. Do you remember when they were trying to confirm the Secretary of Defense Hagel. And somebody had joked, a New York Post writer joked about, oh, you know, I'm surprised he's not coddling up with, I forget, some made-up name, like the Friends of Muslim Extremists or
the
something like
Hamas.
That. Yeah, of Hamas. And then all of a sudden, every single conservative news outlet was covering, oh, my God, Hagel's involved with the Friends of Hamas, until finally the New York Post reporter had to come out and say, look, I was joking. That was tongue-in-cheek. There's no such, you know, group that exists. I mean, that's the scary thing, Michael, about conservatives today, is that they really don't think. And that's, look, I don't mind having a difference of opinion. You're a lawyer. You know, I'm sure you enjoyed moot court and the ability to have discourse and, you know, offer up evidence and facts and go back and forth and argue. That's the way a vibrant democracy should be. But that's not the way the modern conservative looks at things. They are very much automatons and robots and need to be fed things. And It's very scary to see the lack of rationality.
Well, they have this template of sophistry that they use, and it's very typical across the board with most of their arguments. They twist things and they skip and they make self-serving assumptions that are very buried. But basically, they rely on talk show hosts to tell them what to think.
Right, exactly.
They rely on that information and say, okay, that's not biased, but of course the lamestream media is biased, so we won't listen to them. It's
no doubt. All right, listen, Mike, I'm going to get the other calls. Thanks for your time. Appreciate you calling in today. Okay, that's Michael on Sirius Radio. Let's go to the next caller. It'll be Donald, who is listening on WCPT in Oak Brook, Illinois, wants to talk a little bit about the sequester. So, Donald, welcome to the table.
Hi, Doc. How you doing?
Every day's a blessing.
I'm sorry.
I just, you said how I was doing. Get away from my answer. Every day's a blessing.
I about the sequester, you know what really kills me about the Republicans? They don't have a media that holds them accountable for anything. Nothing.
Right.
They get away with murder. And they're getting away with the sequester, too. But I blame a lot on our Democratic politicians that don't get behind this president. I blame it on the Democratic voters that don't get behind this president.
Yeah.
And some of our Democratic analysts that made this our president believe that, you know, okay, go ahead, sign the sequester with them because they would not be stupid enough to go ahead and do this,
sure.
To go ahead forward with it, but they did, and that just goes to show you what type of people you're dealing with here.
They would much rather, Donald, see the American people fail and the president fail if they felt it somehow or another that was going to get them more seats in Congress and more seats in elective offices. That's the sad thing. They put party before people when in reality we should always put people before party or anything else.
Right. And what really, really is frightening me is 2014. Now, they could say what they want, like they're all, some of them are accepting Obamacare. I think they're worried about their positions.
Sure.
And, you know, they are really nothing but a bunch of wolves in sheep's clothing. But the thing is, from what I'm hearing from different talk show hosts, that 2014, they almost got that sewed up. John Boehner's got enough guts now because he feels his position is safe.
Right.
I'm hoping we can get back to House, because if we can, I don't know what's going to happen.
That's where the game of poker is being played right now, Donald, is that, you know, is this going to hurt Obama and the Democrats more than the conservative Republicans? And ultimately, I don't think so, because I think the American people have gotten wise to the tricks and the chicanery and the crap that goes on in the modern-day Republican Party. Look, even a guy like Chris Christie, Chris Christie, you saw when we had the Hurricane Sandy, and he praised President Obama for coming out there and helping out. That's the way people need to work together across the aisles. But because of what Chris Christie did, you heard of CPAC, right, the Conservative Political Action Committee, where they every year have a conference, and they invite, you know, all these up-and-coming and most prestigious conservative leaders. And did you know that Chris Christie was blackballed from that event, that they refused to invite him simply because he happened to compliment Obama on a job well done? And Chris Christie right now has like a 70% plus approval rating in New Jersey, which means he's got broad bipartisan support. So you see, even amongst their own, somebody who potentially could be a viable candidate for the presidency in 2000, 2016, they won't even invite him to a conference because he happened to say some nice things about Obama.
Throw him to the sharks.
Yeah, they want to throw him to the sharks. Well, they'd have a field day with him, though, those sharks. I'll tell you, you have to quite a few sharks. But
oh.
I know, that's below the belt. All right, listen, let me get to the other calls, Donald. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, listen, we're going to have to be going to a break here shortly, but we got the Freedom Lines wide open for everybody right now. I'm going to try to get to everybody as the Freedom Express continues to chug along here, Eric. 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. We still got Jerry, we got Dwayne, Darryl, Joe, Carlos, Daniel, Ron, Chris, Danny, everybody. Just hang out there. The good doctor's going to get to your calls in a quick moment once we go to this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back, my friends, and let's just get right to the Freedom Lines. Lots of people actually holding right now. Let's go to Danny, and he is on WWRL out of Mount Clear, New Jersey. He wants to talk about the Zimmerman trial. You know, we've covered that pretty extensively, Eric. And
oh, yeah.
I think that's going to be another fascinating trial, along, obviously, with the Jody Arias trial going on right now. So let's go to Danny on the line. Welcome, Danny.
Hey, good evening. How are you?
Good, good.
Great, great. My question was pretty much how much of a game changer do you think there's no defense is going to be that they announced yesterday? They're going to drop the
immunity? Well, they can always reinvoke it later. So, but what the lawyer said was that he had a chance to go before the judge under the stand your ground law, and that the judge at that point could have reviewed all of the data, the information, the evidence, and if the judge agreed with Zimmerman's, you know, his case, that he could have dropped the case summarily right there and be done with it. So, but they opted not to do that. But I don't know. Look, I think this guy is going to be I think he's guilty. I mean, come on. The bottom line is he starts stalking this guy. The kid's going home on a rainy day. He just got some Skittles and an iced tea. He's not bothering anybody. And there he is, you know, quote-unquote, in his neighborhood watch and saying this kid looks suspicious. Why did he look suspicious?
I mean, he was his own self-neighborhood watch. He wasn't appointed.
Self-appointed neighborhood watch.
Exactly.
And then, you know, he calls the police 911, which I'm sure they're going to say that that's his cover. That's why he felt sort of threatened. But then he runs after it, like, because the police, if you listen to the audio tape of that 911 call, the police are like, you know, more or less, I'm paraphrasing, but we got it under control. You stay where you are. We're on our way. And he ignored the advice of the police to stand his ground. He should have stayed where he was. Instead, he ran after him. And then ultimately, you know, we know what happened after that. A struggle ensued, some type of confrontation. And the next thing you know, this poor young teenager is lying there dead in a pool of blood. And he's trying to say he was standing his ground. So,
yeah, I guess also, for some reason, I think it's like, the right seems to always gravitate towards defending Zimmerman. Like, as soon as the news broke out yesterday, first thing I hear is people bringing up that Trayvon's girlfriend was caught in a lie, or, you know, they're
right. She was supposed to be in the hospital and she wasn't. You know, of course, they'll try to disparage this young girl's character and integrity now. But look, the bottom line is this: George Zimmerman that day should have minded his own business. He had no business tracking this kid, stalking this kid, and obviously he had no reason to take a gun out and shoot this kid dead. I mean, it's just absolutely...
He was looking for trouble.
He was looking for trouble from the get-go, and I hope he does get his day in court, and I hope he ultimately gets a very serious sentence as a result of this, of murdering this kid. All right, listen, I'm going to get the other callers, Danny. Thanks for your time. Okay, that's Danny on WWRL. Let's see, Eric. Let's go next to – who's holding the longest here? Let's go to Dwayne. Dwayne's online in Sonoma, California. He wants to weigh in, I think, with the sequester thing going on. What's up?
Hey, Mike, a couple of points. About the sequester. Now, earlier this year – no, late last year, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center put out a comment that they were –
concerned that their contracts would not be, they'd be able to cancel them in the event of sequester. Uh-huh. And I was thinking that this may answer the people who earlier today complained about the shortage of ammunition in stores. Possibly if the government was not buying so many, possibly the stores would not be so empty, that it isn't just stocking up by people, it's stocking up by the government. And we'll see whether the sequester cuts the purchases of ammo by the Homeland Security.
Right. What do you think about the sequester overall, though? Just the whole concept of like just taking this axe and just, you know, chopping and chopping and chopping.
Well, I think that the people should eventually be in full revolt about this. That the sequester is just basically a terrorist act on the part of the Republicans.
Right. It's an act of financial terrorism, right?
Yeah, they're going to destroy our economy if we don't let them continue stealing it.
I know what's interesting about this. You know, they call Obama like the socialist commie guy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But just yesterday, and maybe even today, the stock market hit an all-time high, record high, the stock market, okay, the bellwether, if you will, of the United States economy and how well we're doing. And yet here you got this communist socialist in as the president, Eric. And
making capitalism better.
Making capitalism better.
Yeah, well, you see, you got the eyes on the right thing. It's clear that that's the stock market says it all right there. I would make another thing I'd like to see, keep our eyes on in the next few months, that the one of the things that Chavez was accused of was seizing the land from the Heinz ketchup company.
Right.
And that was one of the reasons that he was considered as a, you know, a threat.
Better watch out now with John Kerry, Secretary of State.
Married to the Heinz ketchup company heiress. But there's an interesting little point coming in here. Yeah, the Heinz company was just recently sold to Warren Buffett. And so the question will be, who's going to claim those thousands of acres that they want to take back from the peasants? And are we going to be willing to send U.S. Drones in to enforce a change of government?
Great.
Sounds like
another war brewing, right? That's all we need is another war. All right, listen, let me get to the other calls here. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Dwayne. You have a great day. All right, that's Dwayne online from Sonoma, California. Beautiful area of California, Eric. You like Sonoma?
Yes, I am from California.
Right. I love that. I'm those rolling, verdant hills, wine country, too.
Lots of wine, lots of grapes.
Absolutely. But don't put those – are there such thing as wine goggles too, or no?
Wine goggles?
Yeah, because Tom talked about beer goggles, right. But I assume it just applies
for all
alcohol,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's just wine goggles seems a little classier, a little bit more refined.
Yes.
If you will. Okay, let me give you the number for the Freedom Lines here. Boy, this hour is going by very quickly today. 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. Again, 1-866-987-8466. We're taking your calls for the entire hour today. So let's see. Next up in the queue, let's go to Joe on FSTV, and he is from someplace called Loxahatchee, I think, Florida. I hope I said that correctly. Joe, did I say that correctly?
Yes, you did.
All right, excellent. First time.
Yeah, on this drone thing with the president,
yeah.
In order to have something like that to be effective, would you not have to have a whole network across the entire United States?
What do you mean as far as the drones and where they're
being able to stop an attack at any time?
Well, let me ask you this, because my understanding with the drone story is that the Obama administration or people in the administration have said that it's constitutional legal to use drones within our own border to take people out. And that sounds a little scary.
Who are we going to be taking out?
I know. I'm sure the conservative Republicans would use it to anybody trying to cross the border. But, why would we want to use a drone in our own country?
Right. I mean, we'd still need a network all the way, a whole umbrella of drones 24/7 to enforce that.
Right, right. Yeah, it would be very difficult to do that. I don't know. Look, again, as a physician, I keep saying to myself, hey, why are these people so interested in constantly fighting wars and using aggression and killing people and, ooh, the evil dudes? I mean, let me tell you, there are more terrorists lurking in the microbiological world than there are terrorists in the human species. I mean, you talk about bacteria and viruses and fungi and things like that. I mean, if you go into hospitals nowadays, Joe, and the chance of you getting some type of infection that's resistant to practically every antibiotic that we can come up with That's scary. I mean, that's an enemy that you can't use a drone, you can't use an antibiotic, you can't use anything to destroy some of these bacteria that are developing resistance. So instead of worrying about putting drones up in the air and killing people from afar, we should be funding science, we should be funding the National Institutes of Health, and we should be funding the war against microbiological terrorists, which to me ultimately is a graver threat than
up in the air. Yeah. I mean, now that's another freedom of, well, if these drones are up there, they're always spying on us.
Right, right. No doubt about it.
They'd have to have that spy network up in the sky 24/7 to stop any so-called threats that, you know, for shooting down an airplane, it takes, you know, a few minutes. You'd have to call the president, no matter where he is in the world, to have that strike done.
Right. Now, I hear you. Listen, let me get to some of the other calls, though, because we've got a short time here, but I appreciate your perspective. Thanks a lot. Okay, so
I'm sure here in Arizona, if they had drones, they'd somehow figure out how to determine whether people were Mexican or not.
No, absolutely. Didn't we pass a law, Senate Bill 1070? Can't you determine by just gut instinct?
They can, you know.
The cop can actually, the police
officer. Right, but they can make these drones so that they can actually determine whether somebody's a Mexican.
Right, well, I'm sure they have like
an illegal or
a little telescope on the drone that can kind of zone in.
Like an infrared camera.
Right, and they just like send the picture to the team on the ground, and yeah, that's an illegal, you know, and then just
go get him,
send the drone strike in there, just, you know, bomb them all. Even our own senator John McCain, remember when he was running, he was like bomb Iran,
isn't he know. The one who said build the dang fence
too, right? Absolutely. All right, let's get back to some of the other callers. Let's go to next to Daryl on the line listening on Sirius from Montclair, New Jersey. Wants to talk a little bit about the sequester. Daryl, thank you for your patience. You're live on the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, I'll make this real quick. On the sequester, there is so much room for cutting in the government. And one thing we could do is we could do what Germany did and what Brazil did a few years ago, where they decided they were going to go 50% open source in their government. So right now we have, I don't know, what, 2 million government employees total, about 700,000 or whatever in the Defense Department. I mean, what if we could go 50% and get rid of, you know, I don't know how many, a million?
Biggest place that you can cut, and you can cut and cut and cut as far as I'm concerned, is the military budget. I mean, that is so overfunded that it's ridiculous. And when you look at the lack of funding in science and technology and things like that, education, it's pathetic. Listen, I got to run. We're going to go to a break. We'll be back with more of your calls. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman for hour number 3. Okay, welcome back. This is the final segment of today as the Freedom Express pulls up to its final stop, its final destination for today. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman for hour number 3 today. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to we the people directly across the country. So we're going to get to your phone calls right now at 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. That's 1-866-987-8466. Let me go first to, let's see here. There was one caller that I wanted to look at, Erica. Now, they might have dropped off. All right. Well, in any case, no, here it is. It's Pat from WCPT in Wisconsin. Pat,
where are you listening from?
Welcome to the table.
Yeah, that's actually Illinois. I live on the state line. I live in Wisconsin, but I get CPT out of the Chicagoland area.
Ah, okay.
So,
stop revealing where you are. You know, those drones might find you.
Okay, I live on the state line. They can come get me. Yeah. What I want to talk about is the sequester, because I, for the last almost 30 years, have worked in special needs area in education.
Right.
I work with the high-risk behavior kids, the ADD, HD, and you know what I mean.
Sure, absolutely.
And, you know, I feel like the kid in the wheelchair, the kid that has a mental disability, I have a Down syndrome granddaughter, these are all precious in God's sight. I'm sure of that. Why are they not precious in the Republican sight? And from what I understand from the Wisconsin State Journal, we're going to lose $10.1 million just in Wisconsin in aids to those children. I mean, what kind of people steal from handicapped children?
Well, and they don't they say they're pro-life too, Pat? Aren't they the ones who respect life and just love life? And
you know, I might be that connection that keeps a kid from going to jail, keeps a kid, and they're hard kids to love, but somebody's got to love them. And I can't believe that they're going to turn their back on the, and this is why I call is so people know what's in that sequester.
Sure.
That is
it targets the least of thee.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it's targeting education in general.
Right.
But it, special needs kids are special, and they need.
Right, right. Well, you know, lobbyists are special needs people, too, and they need, you know,
millions
and millions of dollars. So that's the special needs people that they really cater to. Listen, I appreciate the call, Pat. We got a short segment. Thank you for what you do in special education. Okay, that's Pat there. But, yeah, it's crazy what they're doing, Eric, if you really think about what she's saying, how they really are targeting the disabled, the people with intellectual.
And I'm sure if they have disabled children, everything possible is done for their kids. But when it comes to everyone else's, it's like, you know.
Yeah, they could care less. And then the other thing, too, I don't know if you heard this, in Arkansas, the state legislature actually passed a bill, voted on a bill, that would restrict abortions now to 12 weeks
yes.
or less. So if it's
a human heartbeat something,
right,
they
right.
Call it?
So, but then the their own governor vetoed it, saying this is ridiculous, the 12-week you know stipulation, because it would make it the most restrictive abortion bill in the country. But the way that they work at the state legislature in Arkansas, they overrode the veto because you only need a majority to override the veto of the governor in Arkansas, which I think is ridiculous. If you have a governor, that you should at least need a supermajority to override a veto. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens there. Look, obviously, on its face, it's very unconstitutional, and I don't see this law becoming – or this bill becoming ultimately the law of the land of Arkansas. But in any case
they gave it a cool name, the Arkansas Human Heartbeat Protection Act.
Oh, my God. It's just it's so sad. It's really sickening. And then, look, the other thing, you were looking offline, and you looked at – micro-resistant organisms. We were talking about that. And you, what did you come upon? C. diff, right?
If people, C. diff, yeah.
Yeah, C. diff is short for Clostridium difficile, and it's an infection that is more and more, yeah, it's an intestinal infection that's resistant more and more to antibiotics. And how many people, Eric, every year die of Clostridium difficile?
Well, just in the last year, 30,000 deaths, and compared to 32,000 deaths in automobile accidents.
Right, and compared to 3,000 deaths in 9/11, right? So that's 10 times the amount of deaths every year. Right.
Every year. That's just in the last year. So you got to figure it's about the same every year.
Well, it's probably getting worse. If the bug's getting more resistant, then it's going to be worse. You're going to get more deaths because we can't treat it with an antibiotic. So this has always been my point as a physician. When you look at 9/11, it was a terrible tragedy. No question about it. I lost a colleague, you know, in that particular tragedy, a physician who was on one of the planes that went into the Pentagon. And when you really think about it, after that, we declared what? A war on terrorism. And then we've spent billions and billions, if not trillions, of dollars fighting this so-called war on terrorism. You know, you had a dozen or so, however many hijackers there was. But now you have even just Clostridium difficile, one infection, 30,000 people die every year, 10 9/11s every year. It's almost like a 9/11 going off every month. But do you ever hear any of these conservative Republicans talking about the war on resistant microorganisms that's killing 10 times the amount of 9/11 victims each and every year? That's my whole point. We need to get things into perspective. We need to change the way that we look at the world. And when you have intransigent, you know, just sort of very ignorant conservative Republicans in positions of leadership, it's going to be very hard to change the direction of America.
By the way, if you want to see how much money is being wasted on war, go to costofwar.com. Look at that figure, and you can imagine how many things we could probably cure with that money.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Hey, all right, well, let's just get one more quick call, and we got Kelly in from New York City. Kelly, you got like 30 seconds.
Okay, I'll make this quick. If you haven't read the book by Mike Newberry, read it. It's called The Yahoos. It was written in 1964, and it talks about the right-wing extremists, the Birch Rights, the Minutemen, and the American Nazi Party. The same nonsense in 1964 is happening now on the right wing. It's a
crazy
book that everybody should be reading.
All right, well, listen, you got the last word, Kelly, so thank you for calling in. Okay, well, there we have it. It's a wrap, Eric. The Tom Hartman Program, hour number three. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom. Tom will be back at his regularly scheduled time tomorrow. I want to thank everybody and the staff for the opportunity to participate in the program, and thank you, the listeners, for calling in and actually participating in democracy. So as Tom would say, tag, you're it.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.